This interview of Wisdom from the Top was recorded in 2019. From Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, former Secretary of Health and Human Services, Sylvia Matthews-Burwell.
There were a number of things came through the door in the first 3 weeks. I turned to Bill Corr, who was my deputy at that time, and I said, Bill, what's can you help me understand? Because he had been there. And he said, well, Sylvia, sometimes people say that problems come in threes. I'm afraid with you, they come in 33s.
How Sylvia Matthews-Burwell learned to navigate crisis after crisis at the highest levels of the nonprofit world, and then as a member of President Obama's administration. The biggest government agency is not the Department of Defense or the Treasury or even the Agriculture Department. If you consider budgets, it is the Department of Health and Human Services, about $1 trillion a year, because Medicare and Medicaid account for a huge chunk of government spending. But there's also the Food and Drug Administration, Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health, and so on. Keeping Americans healthy is expensive, and running an agency this big is probably the second most difficult job in Washington, right after the presidency. And it's the kind of job where crisis tends to be the norm rather than the exception. Over the 3 years Sylvia Matthews-Burwell ran HHS, she had to contend with the Ebola crisis, thousands of unaccompanied minors showing up at the U.S. border, the Zika epidemic, not to mention dozens of attempts by congressional Republicans to damage and even undermine the Affordable Care Act. When President Obama appointed Sylvia as head of the department in 2014, it was just after the bungled launch of Obamacare. HHS was under intense pressure and congressional scrutiny. In the next 3 years, we're going to test every single lesson she'd learned as a leader, including the most important one. Planning and preparation are key, but always be prepared for that planning to fall apart. Which is actually what happened one night to Sylvia during a Washington Nationals baseball game. She was invited to throw out the ceremonial first pitch, and for 6 weeks, she practiced that pitch, going to baseball fields all over Washington with her husband early in the morning, just to make sure she'd get the ball over the plate. And that night, when she got ready to throw out the pitch, happened to be HHS night at Nationals Park. Thousands of her staffers were in attendance, and I happened to be there as well.
Oh, did you see my disastrous pitch? You were there for that, huh?
It was, it's all right. I mean,
It's actually a very interesting example around the issues of leadership, because I practiced Guy for many weeks, like 6-7 weeks. I can tell you every baseball diamond that is public and open at 6 a.m. in Washington, D.C. And instead of date nights, Stephen and I would go for practice nights. He would be my catcher.
You'd play catch.
We would play catch for date nights.
Wow.
And so practice, got it down. I even practiced on Wrigley Field at West Point.
Wow.
Because I was traveling there, and I'd practiced, as I said, for about 2 months. And our neighbor had played college ball, and his three sons were pitchers, and so he taught me. And but that night, I go there and I warm up, and I warm up under. You warm up under the field
in the bullpen.
Yep, under. Yeah, it's underneath. And so
underneath the field. Okay, this is at Nationals Park.
This is at Nationals Park,
right.
And I'm warming up.
You're gonna throw the first pitch.
Yes, and Steven's like, wow, I'm really feeling it in the glove now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. And then it was one of the hottest days. I don't know if you remember, since you all were there.
It was
really, really hot.
Yeah.
They handed me a ball. I get up there. And, I'd been putting it across the plate just minutes before.
Yeah.
And what I learned is the reason that pitchers put the ball in the dirt. And it was a brand new ball that they gave me to pitch. And so I wind up, I go, and the ball slips out of my hand.
Because your hand is sweating.
And because I didn't get it dirty.
Yeah.
And so it just slips out of my hand. So the good news is that my form in pictures looks quite good. The bad news is I got off the field and my son said to me, "Mom, that's the worst pitch I've ever seen."
Oh,
as did
man.
About 5,000 HHS employees. But I used it in my next HHS letter that I sent out to the team as an example of we all fail. And we all fail even when we try really hard. And the question is what you do with it.
Yeah. You did all the right things.
That's right. And it didn't work out.
Let me first ask you about where you grew up. Because you grew up in Hinton, West Virginia, I guess. Well, where is that, by the way?
Hinton, West Virginia is in the southern part of the state of West Virginia. It's about 4.5 hours drive from Washington, D.C., 5.5 if you have kids that are 9 and 11. And it is on 3 rivers and a lake. It's a very small town in a beautiful part of the world.
What did your parents do when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, my father was an optometrist, and my mother was a teacher. And my mother actually taught in everything from a one-room school to a college that is now a university.
Is the West Virginia that you grew up in, was that a different West Virginia than the West Virginia of today?
I think that there are some changes that have occurred, that the economic difficulties have become greater, that the issues of the opioid crisis are very real in the part of the state that I come from. But in terms of how it can shape and contribute to the sense of community, I think that still very much exists. And the idea of hard work, the idea of taking care of each other, knowing your neighbor, there are a number of things that I think still exist there. But there are some challenges that have gotten harder.
How much does West Virginia shape who you are today?
It shapes me, I think, a lot. I would say it is one of the seminal shaping features of my life. And it's both the place, the community, and my family that I think have so much impact on everything from my intellectual curiosity to how I think about service and how I think about those things.
Yeah. I have to say one quick thing, which is there really is a, in our country, a lack of awareness about service. And it just, I mean, you made that conscious choice and make that conscious choice, right? I mean, I think it's something that a lot of people in the United States don't understand, how many people just are not interested in becoming rich and because they're really focused on, you know, doing work that has that serves the public in a bigger way.
I think that there are two things for me that contributed a lot to that. And one is my family and my parents and what I saw in my parents. I mean, my mom and dad wouldn't let us go trick-or-treating for Halloween until we went trick-or-treating for UNICEF first.
Wow.
So from the hours of 4 to 6, we would take the little box and we would go to all the neighborhoods and we would trick-or-treat for UNICEF.
Wow.
And collect money for UNICEF. Then you'd go back from 6 to 8 and get your candy. You know, a part of it is related to our faith. That is a part of, you know, what you learn in your faith, this importance of service. And I think all of those things are the things that contribute to, for me, why, you know, there's such a strong sense of service. But many people don't appreciate what government service is or what it means.
Yeah. When you grew up in West Virginia, it was a solidly Democratic state, right? It was like the state of Robert Byrd and Rockefeller, Jay Rockefeller, and John F. Kennedy's famous tour, you know, right through West Virginia. And so you became a Democrat. You devoted your sort of public career to serving Democratic leaders. When you go back today, does it feel like the sort of the partisanship is more pronounced? Do people kind of, people have known you, give you grief or even just joke about it? Or is it, does it feel pretty much the same as it did when you were younger?
It feels a little different, but I think people are very good about wanting to hear my point of view and respecting the fact that I am from and part of West Virginia and care deeply about the people and the communities there, and so are willing to listen to why do I have the points of view that I have? What are the facts that I know in terms of those that know me? But I think it does have a different feel because a number of the things don't align necessarily with my points of view. Mm-hmm. In one way, it's also, I think, informing because there is a sense of making sure that those that represent them actually respect them. And I like to say that I think sometimes people in my hometown and other places think that people in Washington on both sides of the aisle have a point of view that isn't respectful of the fact that on Sundays, everybody I know from where I live goes to church, and after church, you have a meal with your family, sometimes at Kirk's Home with a Hungry Smile, where I had my first job as a waitress, or in your house. And then, depending on what's happening, you may watch West Virginia University sports.
Right.
And I think the sense of respect for that as a way of life, the priorities that people have, they sometimes, I think, feel that people have moved away from respecting that.
I know one of the earliest jobs you had in politics was right after you got your undergraduate degree from Harvard. This was in 1987, and you got a job working on Michael Dukakis's presidential campaign. What do you remember from that? I mean, were you like a super junior aide on that campaign?
Yes. Yes, and probably we might just want to back up to the first campaign, which was in 1972, and I worked on Jay Rockefeller's. That was the first time I still had my little Jay button.
Wait, 1972? Were you like 3 years old?
I was seven.
Seven. Okay.
But probably the even more important one occurs the next round, and you may remember that Jay Rockefeller lost that first race for governor. But then he comes back. And in the next round, at this point, I'm in elementary school, and we had started a newspaper, the Central News and World Report. We were granted an interview with the candidate, Jay Rockefeller. We were his first visit as he came to our county.
Wow.
And he came to our memorial building, and he was going to do a speech as a candidate. But the first thing he did was he met with me. He met with Christy Gore Scott and Terry Giles, and we had our tape recorder. For those listening to this who may not be familiar, think a huge, oversized iPhone that could only record.
Right.
And so we had our little reporter notebooks, and we had our questions, and we asked them and then wrote an article for our newspaper, the Central News and World Report. And I do think that that was a turning point for the candidate. I mean, I think that that may have been the start to what led to the victory of that campaign. Obviously, I'm joking. But so my engagement in these things started actually quite early. When I went to the Dukakis campaign, I took time off from the time that I was studying in England. And I did that with some other friends, one of whom was a very close friend, Susan Rice. And I got there to the campaign first.
But by the way, both of you were both of you studying in England?
Yes. And
so both of you were Rhodes Scholars?
Yes. Susan and I are both Rhodes Scholars. Susan was the class ahead of me. And
wow.
Susan was also my basketball coach at Oxford when I was playing for the university as well. But during this was a little before the basketball, I got to the campaign first. And when Susan arrived, I suggested that, Susan, on this campaign, you need to be a Rhodes Scholar to facts and a Marshall Scholar to photocopy. So when you asked, were we junior, the answer to that question is yes. Started on the campaign. I worked for John Podesta.
On the campaign.
Yes, on the campaign. I worked for John Podesta. And I actually worked on debate preparation. So that meant preparing both the candidate and the person playing the opposition in the debates. And so I would do all the fact-checking.
Obviously, that did not end well for the Dukakis campaign. He was defeated in 1988, and you went back, presumably, to finish your degree as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. And then I guess you kind of went into the private sector afterwards. You worked for McKinsey. I'm just curious, when you really started your career, was it always your idea that you would enter into public service, or did you think, you know, let me see where this McKinsey thing takes me?
So I think the answer was a little yes and no, and it gets to a theme that runs throughout my career. And that is, I haven't always been knowing exactly where I'm going. Hmm. And so when pressed to answer a question in my Rhodes interview, Father Tim Healy, who was the president of Georgetown, asked me as part of my Rhodes interview, what are you going to be doing from 10 years from now? Hmm. What I thought at that moment was, I'll work in the executive office of the president. And so I think that was there. But at the time, I went to McKinsey. I want to try this out. I want to see what it's like to learn about this. I had taken my LSATs right before I started at McKinsey because I thought, you know, I'll probably work at McKinsey for 2 years, see what it's like, and then go to law school.
Yeah.
And that's as far as I had gotten.
Right.
And I never got to law school.
You never got to law school. And obviously, you sort of took a detour towards public service, which was 1992, which was an opportunity to join or to be involved with Bill Clinton's presidential campaign. How did that happen? Were you kind of recruited into it?
So in 1992, the convention was held in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister and I both lived and worked in New York City. Our parents came up for the convention. It was wonderful. And started to get the bug a little bit. Like,
yeah.
Wow, this is exciting. It's an exciting time. We have a very exciting candidate who I believed aligned with so many of the views and things that I believed in and that could be done to support our nation and take it to even a better place. And so I thought about it, and I thought, well, I'll just make one phone call. And I had talked to Gene Sperling, who I'd worked with in the 88 campaign. And obviously, I'd worked with George Stephanopoulos in the 88 campaign. And then Gene called and said, can you come down? And so I went to Little Rock, Arkansas. I took a leave of absence from McKinsey. They were great about letting me do that. And went to Little Rock, Arkansas to work on the campaign and be a part of the war room.
Stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Basecamp. The good news is that your business is growing, but so are the number of files, emails, chats, and meetings. It's becoming impossible to stay on top of it all. Your team needs help keeping up. No problem. Join the thousands of growing businesses that sign up for Basecamp each week. It's the all-in-one place solution for organizing and collaborating. Keep it together. Put it in Basecamp. To learn more, visit basecamp.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Indeed. Rapid growth for your business doesn't have to come with growing pains. When you have ambitious hiring goals, you need a partner to help you get there. You need Indeed. Indeed saves you headaches. Interview virtually with no downloads, plugins, or purchases. You can do it all in one place with Indeed. Indeed.com/wisdom. Terms and conditions apply. Cost per application pricing not available for everyone.
Welcome back to Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz.
And your focus was on economics, right? On sort of
economic policy.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Gene Sperling, myself, and a number of others.
That must have been, such an exciting time because obviously it was a young candidate. What do you remember about working in Little Rock in 1992?
It was a highly energized team, and I learned so much about economic policy. I learned so much about politics. I learned so much about leadership, and I hopefully contributed on those fronts as a team member of a team that was going 24/7. Leaders, like James Carville and Paul Begala. James was a Marine, and James had his own style of leadership. But
yes.
One thing that I remember so much, and his ironed jeans that James always wore. But one of the things that I remember most that James did was at one point, James handed out gold stars. And these are the gold stars for anyone who's old enough to remember. When you went to the library in the summer and you read a book, mm-hmm. and you got a little star on a paper thing.
Yeah.
And that was how you recorded the books that you'd read for the summer.
Yeah. It was like a little sticker.
It was those little stickers.
Yeah.
Well, on campaigns, there's not a lot of finances. There aren't a lot of things. But what James did was he created the gold stars. And so every Friday, James would hand out a gold star to a person to honor their work for the campaign that week. And those gold stars were as big as any kind of bonus you could have given. And it was about being honored for your contributions to the team and your contributions to moving us forward. And so everyone, when you got it, you put it on your badge to get into work. And so we all wore our badges every day. And so those gold stars. And it was an incredible lesson about understanding that recognizing people's work and recognizing their contributions to a team is as motivating and as great as about anything you can do.
Obviously, Clinton wins the election, and you, I guess, are tapped to help in the transition to work on the National Economic Council, and eventually you would serve as deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget. 2 years in, there's this Republican wave, and all of a sudden you've got this sort of contingent of Republicans who really are not that interested in working with the Clinton administration. Of course, today it's a completely different story, right? The way it works, but back then it was already sort of the beginnings of this kind of the end of what, let's say, post-war bipartisanship. Do you remember having difficulties trying to negotiate with congressional Republicans, or did you always try and figure out how to get to a deal?
During that time, I can remember Erskine Bowles once said to me, "Sylvia, you attract more bees with honey."
Mm-hmm.
And that was all part of, you know, Erskine's firm belief that you really need to understand what the other side—
And he was the head of the OMB when you were, right?
At that time, Erskine was the chief of staff, and I was a deputy chief of staff.
Right.
And we needed to negotiate. And at that time, it was Trent Lott, Newt Gingrich, and Dick Armey. And Gingrich would have us all over to the dinosaur room. That's what his office was called, because mm-hmm. he had some of the things he kept in the office. And you just had to get through and work it out. And there were many, many late nights. Yes, there was contention. You probably remember there was a government shutdown during
sure.
that period that was one of the longer ones. But you could work to get things done, and that's what we did. Just time and time again, you work to understand where it is we differ, what are the key objectives of either side, how can you find that deal space.
There's a profile of you that I read, and John Podesta, who is clearly a mentor, was a mentor of yours, is quoted in this profile, that, and he describes your time in the Clinton administration as a time when you became an extremely skilled negotiator. Was that a hard-won skill that you learned, or do you think that you had that skill kind of naturally when you got there?
I think that's something that one learns. I think it does harken back to some of the things from my time, and you asked about my community at home in West Virginia, and the ideas of respect and listening to others is an important part. I think one of the skills that kind of I brought from my childhood, but many things you had to learn. And the other thing about negotiating is really understanding the substance. It makes a real difference. So you understand where you can go. You can be creative because you have a depth of understanding. I was very fortunate to be able to watch and observe, and very fortunate, I have to say, to even watch and observe those that one was negotiating against, whether that was Newt Gingrich or Trent Lott, and to try and figure out how do you get things to work when you're trying to get deals done.
When your time with the administration came to an end, did you think that your sort of time in government was also over, that you would now go into the private sector in some form and embark on an entirely new career path?
I have never had a planned place, but how I think about the next steps and how I think about what I'm doing is related to a story. When I was working at McKinsey, I had gone to a dinner party and met a friend's father at this dinner party, and he had asked, would I be willing to consider moving to, I think it was the Bahamas. It was the Bahamas to run part of his construction business. You know, I'm very young at this point. And the idea of like, wow, I'll run my own thing. I'll be in the Bahamas. This sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, this sounds so good. And I was completely taken with this idea. And I call up a friend and a mentor, Tom Donlan.
Who became the deputy...
He was the national security advisor for President Obama.
Yeah.
Then he had been chief of staff at the State Department and served in a number of different roles in government over time. I had had the chance to work with Tom in the 88 campaign. But I called Tom up, and instead of saying, Sylvia, that's the silliest and worst idea, Tom was great and very gracious. And he said, well, Sylvia, here's maybe one way to think about things. When you think about jobs and you think about your career, think about, am I contributing? Am I learning and growing? And am I having fun? And if you can put together 40 years of the answer to that question being yes, you've had a good career. And he said, why don't you think about lining this one up against that? It was very good advice. And so I have tended to think about things in that way and not, am I going to try and be X or try and be Y?
And so was it because of Tom Donlan's advice? Because after the Clinton administration, you decided to kind of make a big change. I mean, you moved across the country to Seattle for a pretty big opportunity.
Yes. And so at that point in time, I was making a change that I thought was going to be exciting. I was going to go to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I thought this was an incredible opportunity to contribute at scale. I felt I would learn something new. And it was going to be an adventure moving to Seattle.
And you ended up staying there for, I think, a decade. You were there for a long time.
Yes. Yes. I arrived in the early days.
You probably got there pretty soon after they changed from the Bill Gates Sr. Foundation to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
That's right, 2001.
And so you moved, you entirely relocated to Seattle for those 10 years?
Yes, yes.
I mean, you mentioned this idea that you didn't have a plan and you didn't have a very sort of a, you know, this kind of methodical path, right? That you pursued things that seemed interesting and meaningful. And so when you were out of Washington, D.C., when you were out of that arena, did it feel like a weight was lifted off your shoulder, or was there still a part of you that kind of missed that action?
I have been very fortunate in, as I've gone from one thing to the other, that I am all in. And when people ask me, which of your jobs have you loved the most? So far in life, the answer to that question is the one I'm in.
So how did you, I mean, when President Obama ran in 2008, a lot of your friends were getting involved in that campaign. Susan Rice and people you knew from the Dukakis, probably your days as a Rhodes Scholar and working on the Dukakis campaign, were getting involved. Was there part of you that was kind of thinking, maybe I should get involved in this thing?
So actually, it was at a point in our lives, my life and my husband Stephen's life and our daughter Helene's life, that was not the thing that was going to be right for us as a family. Mm-hmm. We had made a decision, Stephen and I had made a decision that we wanted our second child to be through adoption, that's how our family would be made complete. And as this campaign was going, we were starting that process. And mm-hmm. so we were quite clear that this would not be the right time for us to make that kind of transition for me to go back and serve in government.
Were you conflicted, at least initially during the primary, over who to support, having worked for Bill Clinton and seeing some of your friends and colleagues and people you respected working for Barack Obama?
Yes, but I supported Hillary Clinton initially, and then as the Clinton campaign came to a close, I supported Barack Obama.
So it sounds like you had this plan with, obviously, with your personal life to kind of focus on that that process and the adoption process. But you were eventually recruited to come back to Washington in 2013 to work for the OMB, to eventually run the OMB. When you were asked to do that, you know, oftentimes people say when the president asks you to do something, you do it. Was that the way you saw it, or was it something that you were ready to do, like you were ready to come back to Washington, ready to get back into politics and government?
So the issues of presidential personnel and hiring, I am quite respectful of and sensitive to. And so in the first round, I wanted to help and support President Obama. I was so excited about his election, but knew that it wasn't the right time to serve. And my husband, we had made that decision. And so what I said was, I'll do anything I can to help in the transition, to help this new president get off to the right start, whatever it was, anything you wanted me to do. And so I led the transition of the FDIC. You may remember that this was a time of crisis.
Sure.
In the financial industry. Many of my friends were working on the Treasury transition, and I did the FDIC piece. And so the answer to the question of the president calls and you serve, I think that's a very true thing, but I think one needs to have done some good thinking before so that you know your parameters. So I came into the FDIC, I said, I'll do anything in the transition, and I don't want to continue serving, so that would, you know, inform people about how they thought about it and laying out those parameters. Similarly, in the second term of the Obama administration, my family, we had just moved to Arkansas. We had only been in Arkansas a year.
Because you moved there to work to run the Walmart Foundation.
That's right, and their women's economic empowerment work. And so it was a very high bar for me to leave that job and for us to move as a family. And so my husband and I had discussed that there would be only a select number of things that would be important enough to serve and a good enough fit in terms of my skills and things that I would bring that we would consider it. And one of those things was the director of OMB.
You get to the Obama administration like in the middle of heated budget battles with congressional Republicans. The congressional Republicans are having none of the Obama administration's budget proposals. Did you have to just jump into it right away?
Yes. As a matter of fact, my first day, the furloughs were occurring. And furloughs, because of the way that caps had been set and spending had been, the sequester had been put in place, this was part of the way that people met the ability to do that. And because OMB is all people, you can't cut out other things because OMB is just the Office of Management and Budget is an organization that's just really all people. We don't have programs. There's not a lot of travel. There's just the people. And so the day I arrived, I think, was the alternate furlough day. So you furloughed a bunch of people one day and then furloughed other people the other day. So you kind of keep the thing going. So, yes, it was in the middle of what was a very difficult budget time.
Because you knew that the money was running out.
That's right.
And how much time when you arrived did you have before the money would run out?
At that point, we were working on, I arrive in April, and we're working on getting a negotiated budget deal for October 1st.
I mean, were you personally going to Capitol Hill and talking to congressional leaders about the budget and explaining it to them?
So I arrive and the president's budget has been submitted. So now it is about the question of what will be the budget that the Congress will pass.
Right.
And so the objective was to get levels of funding that could relieve some of these difficult situations and negative pressure that's occurring. At this point, things that are happening, our Air Force isn't flying as many training flights. They've grounded people because they can't afford To do that. And so the objective is to get a high enough level of spending that then you can split it across all the departments of government and get us back to a level where base functioning is occurring as it was. And so that's where I kind of get on the merry-go-round. And so then you're starting that work on how do we get ourselves out of this thing, the sequester, that is causing so much difficulty in terms of how the government functions for the American people.
When did it become clear to you that there was going to be no deal, that congressional Republicans, not enough of them, would support this budget?
You know, I was hopeful to the very end, because when you're the director of the Office of Management and Budget, it's your memo that shuts down the government. And so obviously, we had to put the plans in place. You have to do the calls with the departments. The departments have to put forward proposals of how they're going to function. It was a little hard to understand that we were going to shut down the government over funding for the Affordable Care Act.
That was a sticking point.
That was a large part of the sticking point, that there were some members who just would not go forward.
Some of the most conservative members of
Congress,
I remember the time, basically said, we're not going to support this unless we defund the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. They didn't want to support it with congressional funding anymore.
That's correct.
Obviously, you were not the only negotiator. There were tons of negotiators. There were legislative liaisons, and the president was involved, and there were congressional Democrats involved. But did it get to a point where you just realized that nothing could be done? You could not, you yourself personally could not do anything to avoid a shutdown?
There came a point where, you know, there's a clear realization that this is about the votes and that there was nothing more we could do to support the Republican leadership in getting those votes.
So at that point, I guess the only thing you can do is manage a shutdown to the best of your ability.
That's right. And it's a very difficult thing because the laws that surround shutdown actually have criminal offenses. Because the point is, if you do not have an appropriation by Congress, you can't spend the taxpayers' money. There are exceptions, but defining those exceptions is quite a hard thing to do. All the loans for small businesses, you know, the processing of those loans just stops. And what that means, if you were getting ready to start your small business and have been banking on that loan, it's all the things that people don't even consider. I mean, the FDA checking food on a regular basis,
yeah.
You know, that kind of thing, because that's not an immediate danger to health. We have the FDA doing that because we catch things. And so it's just thing after thing every day. There are new issues and new problems coming in. I met with the president every single day during the shutdown to brief him on, you know, what were the biggest challenges, what were the concerns, and were we making progress on getting a deal?
And I think that lasted like 16 days, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's correct.
I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. We'll be right back. This is Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. Afterwards, you released a report basically showing the cost of it. I mean, I remember congressional Democrats, President Obama, their argument was this was just an unnecessary self-inflicted wound, but it's going to have a huge impact on the economy. And you released a report showing that, like, you know, just the salaries alone for furloughed employees cost the government $2 billion. It was like 6.5 million days of lost work and tons and tons of statistics in this report. I mean, were you just personal? Like, I'm just curious personally, because you don't strike me, and I've never seen you kind of express outrage or anger. But I mean, was a part of you just really mad about this? Because the argument from the administration's perspective was this was unnecessary.
Yes, it was unnecessary, and mad interacts with sad because, like, the people who work hard and pay their taxes, I want them to get the value for that money that, you know, we owe that to them. And the people who work hard every day, and nobody wants to talk about the details. Everybody wants the story of the day. But I mean, the aggregate problem that gets caused when you do this is just something that the American people don't deserve, and those who are working hard and playing by the rules every day and coming to work in government don't deserve either. And so it's something that's quite saddening when it happens.
I'm just curious. I mean, as you kind of moved from OMB and then you were nominated to run Health and Human Services, I think it's the third biggest federal agency, right? Is that right? Is it the second biggest? Maybe Pentagon, USDA, and HHS?
By people, by dollars, it's the largest.
Wow.
Right. So with the budget, it's a budget of over $1 trillion.
Because of Medicare and Medicaid.
And Medicaid.
Right.
That's right.
So you're running the biggest department. And during your tenure, I mean, you're dealing with congressional Republicans who want to repeal or severely cripple the Affordable Care Act. You've got this Zika virus, the Ebola epidemic, unaccompanied minors coming to the border through Central America. How did you think about managing all of these different crises? I mean, that's a lot to deal with.
There were a number of things, and it increased the challenge. Like three of the first things came through the door in the first 3 weeks. I turned to Bill Corr, who was my deputy at that time, and I said, Bill, like, we have, you know, a Supreme Court decision that came against us. We have, you know, the children coming across the border. We have just opened up the emergency response center in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Ebola. You know, Bill, what's can you help me understand? Because he had been there. And he said, well, Sylvia, sometimes people say that problems come in threes. I'm afraid with you, they come in 33s. and that was kind of what I, as you're indicating, I walked into. And so it became important to very quickly get to the core objectives in each of the crises, like get to clear measures of, like, what did we all agree would be the measures of success so that we can all, like, here's what we're working against, and then we can align and do that. And then the other thing that's extremely important when you have that many balls in the air is the strength of the teams that you have in place. And on a daily basis, really focusing what are the big rocks that you need to move when you have that many crises going. And the other thing is, you know, the rest of the department can't be ignored either. So how do you put in place tools that support the other members of your team as they're trying to do the day-to-day work that must continue even while you're in crisis?
Let's just break down these different crises for a moment. I mean, Ebola, for example. Remember there were projections from serious NGOs that this is going to be an enormous epidemic, like that perhaps hundreds of thousands of people would die and maybe even spread to the U.S. at some point. I mean, you must have seen those projections early on. I mean, how worried were you about Ebola?
Very worried. Ebola was a very difficult challenge because it was something we had never seen Ebola spread at this scale. We'd never seen it in concentrated population areas spreading. We'd never seen it at the numbers that you had that were doing everything from undermining the healthcare systems to the economies of the countries in which they were in. And furthermore, we had never seen Ebola on our shores. While it was one of the largest and most difficult crises that I've had, you know, worked on in government, it's also the one where I would reflect that the government worked together the best I have ever seen it.
So when it came to the Affordable Care Act, you were actually named, right? There was a Supreme Court case with your name on it where the Supreme Court once again essentially upheld the basic provisions of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, did you genuinely believe at that time that you could still forge bipartisan solutions and compromises over policy like healthcare, like, you know, did you still feel like that was a possibility?
Yes. But on that, I will start with a place where I was a little let down. And I was let down by two lawyers. When I took the job at HHS, I did not understand that all Supreme Court cases would switch to my name. Hobby Lobby versus Burwell, King versus Burwell, that all these cases would switch my name. And I was let down by two lawyers. One of them, my husband, who's an attorney who didn't warn me about this, and the other one, the President of the United States, who's also an attorney, in terms of all the cases that would then come. And you're right, some of those cases were supported by other members in Congress. But I did believe, and I do believe, that you can get things done. And one of the things I did was I had these breakfasts, and they were called, I called them my common ground breakfasts. Mm-hmm. And we would invite all of the authorizers and appropriators of all the committees of HHS, House and Senate, ranking and minority, to breakfast.
At the Department of Health and Human Services?
Yes.
You
yes,
do this once
yes.
a month or once a week? Or
I did it about, it was almost every 2 months.
Right.
The only rule of the breakfast was the only topics we would discuss in the breakfast were the topics that we thought we could get to common ground. We discussed delivery system reform, opioids for which there was legislation, issues like global health security, Zika and Ebola, and issues like that, where we could work to get things done. And the idea was breakfast was about creating those relationships and having conversation about where do we see the places where we thought something could happen. Hmm. And how could we work to get that done?
And did you think they worked?
Yes.
I mean, particularly with congressional Republicans?
Oh, yes. I think that they were, I think there are many things that contributed, but I do think they built the muscles for there are areas where we can get along and move things and move the ball forward and contribute to it.
I think it's fair to say that there are many congressional Republicans and even many members of this administration, the current administration, who don't want to see government work, who don't actually agree with the notion that their job is to make government function, but that their job is to cripple government, hobble government to allow them whatever, the marketplace or, I mean, do you think it's safe, it's fair to say that it is as bad as it's ever been, that as you've ever seen it?
It's certainly, I think, as bad as I've ever seen it. But I don't find that an excuse for not putting in the effort and the energy to try to get us back to a place that can work and to get things done. That's not to say it's not hard. That's not to say it's not frustrating. But I believe it's what you come to do if you take these jobs.
Alice Rivlin, who is one of your predecessors at OMB,
And mentors.
She died recently. And after her death, I remember reading an article that essentially said her death kind of marks also the death of the technocracy, the people who really were focused on solutions-oriented government, who, you know, may have been Democrats or Republicans, but weren't really that partisan, that they were focused on solutions. And I think you would probably put yourself in that category of a more of a technocrat than a kind of a partisan, you know, warrior, right? And I have to say, Sylvia, I think I agree with that. I think we're at a moment now where technocrats, people who are solutions oriented, they're not being listened to. Would you agree with that?
I think that the problem you're articulating may go beyond the issues of government. That this has to do with how people think about knowledge and substance and facts, and viewing the question at that level, then asking what's the role of government. If the problem is broader than just the question of how government works, what is the role of government? And I would, you know, posit that the role is for our leaders to lead. And the role is that, you know, the more of us that are willing to say, call it when you see it in terms of the substantive issues. Like, no, let's make sure we get the facts. Let's, before we go off on tangents of, you know, words that just are supposed to represent different things to different people. I think it's a broader issue, and I think government has a role. And I think it is hard, and I think it is the worst that I've seen. So I'm not being Pollyanna about the problem.
Yeah.
I'm just being what you probably get a sense of. Certain ways, I'm just like realistic, you know. As my mother used to say, I don't make the rules.
What is yeah? But what is the way out? I mean, every day brings a new crisis or a new outrage or things that like you talk about how you had these bipartisan breakfasts, and when Congress asked for information from your departments, you provided it to them. Like, that is not happening now. It's a complete break with, you know, the way government has worked. How do we reverse it? How do we get out of it? How do we actually get back to a place where government kind of functioned, or you know, people talked across the aisle?
I think that there are sort of two different things. There are the basic norms of how things work, and then there's working together on problems. And I think we have to work on both of those. And a part of that is getting to the place where leadership thinks it's valuable to do that, that that is the best way forward. And I think that's an important step. With regard to the reestablishment of norms, I actually think that's the harder part. Because once this has happened, the temptation is just to keep down the path.
Right.
Because someone didn't have to obey the rules, so why should I?
Right.
And so we are going to have to find leadership with great integrity that's willing to say, I understand it, and I understand it's hard, and I understand it makes it harder, but we've got to move forward in the reestablishment of the norms. And those norms, as I said, I don't think it's just here in Washington, D.C. I think it's across the board.
I'm curious, when you go to West Virginia and you have conversations with folks, if you have a conversation with somebody who says, you know, Sylvia, all this talk about, you know, global warming is nonsense, or, you know, all this, the lies of the fake media about this president and the elites in Washington who are feeding us lies and so on and so forth. So how do you, what do you say? How do you communicate your views and your ideas back home when you encounter people who, you know, believe those are elitist views?
So, interestingly, often it is the integrity of the source that is the thing at question. In terms of when I say, well, you know, actually I have been there, or I saw this, or, you know, actual real experiences, it's not making the assumption that people aren't logical or aren't thinking things through. That's not necessarily at all what's happening. But it is this question of how they, what they consider fact and substance, and helping them to get to that.
You are now leading a university. You're the president of American University in Washington. And there's also enormous changes happening on university campuses about speech, about what, you know, the limits of speech, about conduct, identity. And there are all kinds of issues that students are working through about race, gender, politics. Does any of it concern you, or?
I think that it is concerning, and it is different. What's happening around the country happens in more acute in these communities that are universities.
Mm.
But I also think we also have opportunities to try and contribute to creating the thinkers and leaders of tomorrow that can be a part of the solution space. And the way we work on this issue is working through what we call inclusive excellence. And it's the idea that in our campus community, that if we do not have inclusion, and that's inclusion broadly defined, that is inclusion of race, of sexual orientation, of political point of view, which is one of the criticisms that many have of universities, that, you know, can you have differing that this idea of inclusion is what will make us excellent. And so how do we get to that, where that inclusion can occur, and can occur in respectful ways, and ways that don't harm? Harm is being done at times and places. I think you probably know on our campus,
mm-hmm.
We have had some of those issues. I mean, we have had hate crimes that have been investigated by the federal authorities. And so there's a whole spectrum. And what happens in the conversation is, depending on which side you sit, when you hear this, you automatically go to your place of what you think. And this is, again, where the substance is really important. What are the facts? about, you know, that's one thing that social media doesn't always help us. It helps us move information quickly. But does it help us sometimes move the nuance and the details and the facts of information that are actually important to where people, if you had those facts, would sit or stand or think are the cases?
Yeah, I mean, even with all of your experience, right, running huge foundations, running the biggest government agency, running the federal budget, that there's still been a steep learning curve running a university, right? Because you are dealing with an entirely new population of human beings who have legitimate concerns, right? And young people are more diverse. They have legitimate reasons to worry about hate speech, right? I have to imagine all these issues have been new for you and have required you to actually become educated as well.
Yes, the learning curve has been steep. It is great. It is great to learn. Being at a university, you're very close to those that you serve in a way that you hear from them much more directly. It's obviously some days challenging, but I do welcome the voice of our students as well as our staff and our faculty in advancing the thinking and getting these issues right, because it's not easy. That's one of the things that I think is very important, is that we as a community recognize that things are hard and we as a community work together when they are hard.
From a very early age, you showed leadership instincts, right? You were the president of your high school class and you were involved in political campaigns even as a kid. Do you think that you had that in you, that leadership was a part of you and your DNA, or do you think you had to learn how to become a leader?
I think I did a lot of learning along the way. I think you are the personality that you are. But I just think a lot of what is around you contributes. Your personality is your personality. But there's a lot that's contributed as you kind of grow and learn.
So for you, a little mixture of both?
I think, yes. A mixture of both with a very heavy dose of so many people contributed to what I am able to do today. So the heavier dose on the learn.
That's Sylvia Matthews-Burwell. She's currently serving as American University's 15th president and the first woman to undertake that role. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR.